Welcome back for the second of a two-part episode on the clinical assessment of Alzheimer's disease, all based on abstracts published in March 2022. You'll hear about the evaluation of traditional and digital tests for their potential to help us detect Alzheimer's disease or to distinguish it from mild cognitive impairment. Also in the menu, a few papers on markers of cognitive decline that may help us refine our diagnosis, or even for prognostic purposes. Yes, you heard this correctly. All this goodness packed in one episode coming right away. Welcome to Aminder, a podcast where we summarize the latest publications on Alzheimer's disease for you, so you can spend more time doing awesome research. For every month, you'll find a series of episodes by theme, and each comes with a bibliography. Whether you're in the lab, on the bus, or cooking your meal, we hope you find this podcast useful and accessible. This is Sara Luiti, your host for this episode on clinical assessment in Alzheimer's disease. I always find this topic fascinating because it ties very well with my professional interests. I'm currently in medical school preparing to start clerkship in 2 weeks. Ooh, that's our third year and our switch from 2 years of mostly theoretical learning on Zoom for me to practical training in clinical rotations. At Aminder, I currently host this episode on clinical assessment and may apply some of the stuff I share here in real life very soon. You may also know me from older episodes on amyloid beta aggregation and neuroinflammation, which is what I studied in my master's work in the Cashman Lab at the University of British Columbia. So hopefully I can share some of my enthusiasm for this topic while I cover abstracts published in March 2022, where researchers try to develop or refine clinical assessment tools. This is the second of a two-part episode, so make sure you check part one released a few days ago, where slotted papers focused on testing a specific neurocognitive domain. Today's abstracts are a bit more general, but varied, looking at either cognition as a whole or testing multiple domains. We have a few abstracts towards the end that incorporate technology to better screen for Alzheimer's, so I hope you stay with me till the end. You may have noticed that I said I'm covering abstracts, not papers. This is what we do at Aminder. We conduct a search on PubMed using the word Alzheimer. We download all the abstracts for the primary papers that result from the search. We sort them into distinct categories to shape these episodes. Then we summarize them for you in these flash news-like podcasts. If a paper catches your interest, you can find the full citation in our numbered bibliography linked in the show notes. The goal is not to replace the process of reading and critically appraising these papers, but we want to help you keep up with what's out there so you don't have to do those tedious searches on PubMed and so that you don't have to skim through hundreds of titles and abstracts. We do that for you. I have to thank Ellen Rowe for conducting the search and the team members who processed hundreds of abstracts published in March 2022 to categorize them by aim and methods. And that would be Christy, Ellen K, Ben, Eden, Nyla, Frischelli, and Kira. Our team is big, international, and made of wonderful scientists who deeply care about science communication. If this resonates with you, consider joining us. Get in touch on social media, on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, or send us an email at aminderpodcast@gmail.com. Perhaps this selection of summaries will tickle your fancy or even intrigue you and draw you to considering our invitation. I like to start these episodes with some background information so that we're all on the same page. The background doesn't change much between episodes, so I apologize if this gets repetitive over the months. The definition of dementia, mild cognitive impairment, and psychometrics don't vary with time, luckily for us. You can use the timestamps in the show notes to jump ahead to a section and avoid some of this rambling if it's not interesting to you. First, let's get our terminology straight. You may hear terms like dementia, Alzheimer's, and mild cognitive impairment being thrown around interchangeably. However, they're definitely not the same. Dementia is an umbrella term for a syndrome that manifests as a loss in cognition that interferes with functioning. This is not only trouble with learning and remembering, but also can manifest as problems with language or reasoning, for example. These impairments can have different etiologies, and the most common one is Alzheimer's disease, claiming 60 to 80% of dementia cases. This is perhaps the reason why there may be some confusion about the distinction between them. People with Alzheimer's typically have trouble with memory that affects their function, so dementia. But not everyone with dementia has Alzheimer's. Other causes of dementia include vascular problems, such as repeated strokes, or Parkinson's dementia, which develops with time in people with Parkinson's disease, or frontotemporal dementia, where the pathology is seen in the frontal and temporal lobes and therefore affects personality and behavior. Mild cognitive impairment, or MCI, refers to impairments in cognition and not always memory, but don't necessarily affect function. Mild cognitive impairment presents itself with different pathologies, and the one type of MCI you may hear about the most in the context of Alzheimer's is amnestic MCI, or AMCI, versus non-amnestic MCI, which affects cognitive skills other than memory. In amnestic MCI, the patient is less able to form new memories. So we're talking about anterograde amnesia, and this without a big impact on their other cognitive or social abilities. 10 to 15% of them go on to developing Alzheimer's, so in research, you'll often see amnestic MCI being described as prodromal Alzheimer's, and you can understand how accurately detecting amnestic MCI can be very useful in defining a prognosis for a patient and help plan for management. You'll find that many of the papers covered today have this core objective to differentiate Alzheimer's from amnestic MCI. First, I lumped 5 papers that evaluate traditional neurocognitive tests or tools. Then after the midway break of this episode, I will come back with 4 abstracts that focus on identifying new markers of cognitive decline for the screening of Alzheimer's or for prognostic purposes. So let's get started. Our very first paper today is titled Retention and Impairment of Neurocognitive Functions in Mild Cognitive Impairment and Alzheimer's Disease with a Comprehensive Neuropsychological Test. It was published in Neuropsychopharmacological Reports by first author Xiao, last author Sora, who come from Kobe University Graduate School of Medicine in Japan. We need criteria to determine if a test is fit to measure cognitive changes. In the context of schizophrenia, for example, we can use a battery called MATRIX, Consensus Cognitive Battery, and this very same tool could be repurposed or reused in other contexts, such as MCI and Alzheimer's. The authors of this abstract use the Japanese version of this battery across a total of close to 50 individuals. They found that those with MCI and mild Alzheimer's had similar difficulties on processing speed, verbal learning, and visual learning when compared to cognitively healthy participants. Only affected in mild AD were reasoning and problem solving, which is interesting given that later in this episode, you'll hear that the authors of Abstract 7 found these skills to remain unchanged in AD. So stay tuned for that. As for verbal and visual abilities in working memory, they were also impaired in MCI and Alzheimer's, but more so in Alzheimer's. Other cognitive domains were tested, such as attention and social cognition, and seemed to show no difference between cognitively healthy MCI and Alzheimer's groups. Therefore, the Japanese version of the MATRIX Consensus Cognitive Battery shows potential in parsing through different areas of cognition affected in Alzheimer's, as well as normal aging. The next paper also looks at evaluating cognitive tests. And before we move on to it, I feel like a reminder about psychometrics is in order because it will come handy for this abstract. You may have already heard of test sensitivity and specificity as important psychometrics to determine the fitness of a test. Test sensitivity refers to how good your test is at detecting a feature or a parameter, or for our purposes, a disease. So if your patient has Alzheimer's, you want to make sure the test picks it up. The more sensitive the test, the more likely it is to pick up people who do not have the disease. I like to think about it like a rake with very, very tight teeth. The tighter, the more likely it is to catch the branches, but it may actually catch leaves and bugs in the process. A specific test, on the other hand, helps you distinguish between those who have the disease and those who don't. The specificity is measured based on how well it excludes those who do not have the disease, so in other words, true negatives. So the test identifies all those who do not have Alzheimer's in your sample. It would be considered to be highly specific and would be great for ruling out conditions. A very high specificity, however, could miss some of those who do have the disease. These values are inherent to the test and help the administrator determine if the test is appropriate. This becomes even more relevant when we talk about screening versus diagnostics. In the context of Alzheimer's disease, or MCI, the Montreal Cognitive Assessment is a good screening test with a sensitivity of 90% or more, depending on the source you check. You'll see that in the next paper. This means that 90% or more of those with dementia will score low on MoCA. However, if someone scores low on MoCA, you can't say for sure that they actually have dementia. It's possible that another reason accounted for their low score, but if they do have dementia, it's very likely that they were identified by this test. I hope I gave you an appreciation for psychometrics and cognitive assessment, because this is all abstract number 2 is about. And this one's titled Evaluation of the Accuracy of Cognitive Screening Tests in Detecting Dementia Associated with Alzheimer's Disease, a hierarchical Bayesian latent class meta-analysis. It was published in Journal of Alzheimer's Disease by first author Wang and last author Zhu, who are affiliated with Capital Medical University in Beijing, China. Here, the authors evaluate the mini mental state exam and the Montreal Cognitive Assessment for their accuracy. This seems pretty basic, since both are routinely used clinically. But actually, this is a question that came up a lot in our dementia week at school. Which is better in detecting Alzheimer's? The MMSE or MoCA? Do you know? Let's find out. They conduct a meta-analysis of 67 papers published in English and Chinese prior to August 2021 across different platforms. They reported the following psychometrics. They found that MoCA outperformed the MMSE in sensitivity with 0.934 beating 0.883. If you remember our intro, you may guess what this means. MoCA is better at detecting AD than the MMSE, according to the study. However, the MMSE did slightly better than MoCA in specificity, as in 0.9 versus 0.899. Oh, very close. This means that the MMSE does a slightly better, if not equal, job than the MoCA at distinguishing AD from other causes. The authors also found that MoCA had a lower negative likelihood ratio, meaning it could help us cross out dementia associated with AD from our list of potential diagnoses. They conclude that generally, if you need to screen for dementia associated with AD, better use MoCA than the MMSE. The next abstract evaluates a test commonly used in conjunction with the MMSE, that is the clock drawing test. You'll find abstract number 3 published in the International Journal of Geriatrics and Psychiatry under the title Diagnostic Performance and Neural Basis of the Combination of Free and Pre-drawn Clock Drawing Tests. The first author is Imei and last author is Narumoto, and all authors are affiliated with Kyoto Prefectural University of Medicine in Kyoto, Japan. If you haven't heard of the clock drawing test before, it's quite simple. The participant is asked to draw a clock and is given specific instructions as to the time that needs to be shown with the arms of the clock. So, for example, 10 past 10. This format is the free clock drawing test. In another format called the pre-drawn test, the participant is given a sheet with a pre-drawn circle on it so they don't have to draw it themselves. The clock drawing test helps to test not only visuospatial skills, but also the person's ability to plan and therefore their executive function. So it can be a useful tool for evaluating different neurocognitive domains and complete the clinical picture when we try to diagnose Alzheimer's disease. Now back to the paper. The authors want to evaluate the diagnostic relevance of this tool, comparing the free drawing and pre-drawn formats. They look retrospectively at 165 individuals who are either cognitively healthy or have Alzheimer's or amnestic MCI. These groups were further subcategorized depending on their performance on the two formats of the clock drawing test into those who could do both the free and pre-drawn tests, those who could do neither, and those who couldn't do one of the tests. The authors wanted to see if one method was better at detecting AD versus a combination of both. The marker they used for comparison was gray matter volume. Do you want to place a bet? Mine is on the combination of methods, but let's see. The authors found that the area under the curve for the combination of methods surpassed that of either method alone in distinguishing AD from amnestic MCI and healthy controls. They also report differences between groups in gray matter in the left or right or both temporal lobes, depending on their performance on the test, which I'll let you discover in the original abstract or the paper itself. They conclude by recommending the combination of the free and pre-drawn clock drawing tests to screen for Alzheimer's disease and even other brain abnormalities. Is that what you had guessed? Authors of the next two papers also want to detect Alzheimer's and discriminate it from MCI. To do this, they suggest to utilize technology in conjunction with neurocognitive testing. Surprisingly, we do not get too many papers on this in this episode. Just a sprinkle every month. Abstract number 4, it's titled A Digital Screening System for Alzheimer's Disease Based on Neuropsychological Test and a Convolutional Neural Network System Development and Validation. It was published in the Journal of Medical Internet Research by first author Chia and last author Chu, who are affiliated with the National Taiwan University as well as the Taipei City Xishan Senior Home. Here, the authors use the Ray Ostereff Complex Figure Neuropsychological Test to develop a digital screening system in Taiwan. The ultimate goal is to better distinguish Alzheimer's from MCI and, of course, cognitively healthy individuals. They describe the steps in pre-training, feature extraction, and the transfer of learned features for deep learning. That's all in the abstract. They collect data from participants in two ways, either traditionally using pen and paper or using tablet and smart pens. I believe they wanted to compare the two approaches, but they don't really contrast the results in the abstract. They report the mean area under the receiver operating characteristic curve, or AROC, for distinguishing between different groups using one or the other method. For example, they note that AROC for comparing MCI to healthy controls is 0.913 when using pen and paper, but they don't report the value for digital data collection. Perhaps they mean to say that pen and paper data collection is best to distinguish MCI from healthy controls, but this is pure conjecture on my part. On the other hand, they state that when differentiating between Alzheimer's and healthy controls using digital methods, the AROC value was 0.95. But I don't see a value for traditional methods to compare to this value for digital methods. What a tease. I'd imagine we will find more in the full paper, for which you will find a full citation in the bibliography. The authors conclude that their scoring system is proficient in distinguishing AD from MCI and healthy controls and outperforms their previous system as well as other existing ones. If this abstract tickled your curiosity, then perhaps you'll also like the next one, which continues on the same theme of using technology for screening to assess cognitive function. Paper number 5 is titled Boston Cognitive Assessment, or BOCA, a comprehensive self-administered smartphone and computer-based at-home test for longitudinal tracking of cognitive performance. It was published in BMC Neurology by first author Vyshechetsky and last author Gold, who are affiliated with Boston University, Alzheimer's Light in Miami, Center for Integrative Medicine in George Washington University, and William James College in the U.S. too. Here, the authors want to evaluate the Boston Cognitive Assessment, or BOCA, a test that can be self-administered at home in 10 minutes. It tests multiple neurocognitive domains like memory, language, visuospatial reasoning, executive function, attention, and mental math. One distinguishing feature of this test is that it tries to limit practice effect by selecting not repeating tasks randomly. The presence study looks at about 100 individuals who are cognitively impaired or healthy, who are age and education matched. They all take BOCA and their scores are compared to evaluate the proficiency of this test in distinguishing between the two groups. The authors also contrasted these scores to the Montreal Cognitive Assessment, or MoCA. They found that the scores were indeed significantly different between the two groups and correlated well with results on MoCA. Moreover, they tested practice effect, which is the potential to show improvement because of mere practice, and they did so by looking at test-retest reliability. They found that even when taken daily for 10 days, BOCA remained true to itself and did not give significantly different results. Wait, there's more. Do you think it makes a difference whether BOCA is taken on a big screen or a smartphone? According to this study, not really. The authors concluded by praising BOCA's potential to better track cognitive decline longitudinally in a way that is accessible and cost-effective. My one qualm is that if I were to cover another paper on BOCA in this podcast, I'd have to find a way not to enunciate it so you don't confuse it with MoCA. Huh. This marks the end of this section on evaluating existing tests, and we move on to the second part of this episode focused on identifying markers of cognitive decline. But wait a minute. This marks the midpoint of this episode, and time for a more pleasant voice to come give you an announcement. Ellen?
Hi, I'm Ellen Rowe, host and co-founder here at Aminder. I've been with the team since the very beginning in 2020, and I really love it because it's an outlet to hone my own science communication skills, and I feel super passionate about the mission of making sure scientists are well informed about all of the new research being churned out. It's also super rewarding to be a part of a community of like-minded and driven scientists from all career stages. If you're interested in getting involved with our team, we are currently recruiting new hosts and content creators for the show. This is a great opportunity for researchers interested in keeping up to date with the latest Alzheimer's research and getting some science communication experience in the process. If this has piqued your interest, you can reach us at aminderpodcast@gmail.com or through any of our social media platforms, and we'd love to hear a bit about you.
Nearly 1 million older Canadians live with a form of dementia. This number is expected to double within 10 years, and sadly no solutions exist yet to dramatically reduce these numbers. It has to stop. Research can help solve this problem. We are 350 researchers fully dedicated towards preventing and finding a cure to dementia, and to improve care to those living with dementia. We are the Canadian Consortium on Neurodegeneration in Aging. The solution to dementia could be closer than you think.
Welcome back from the break. Let's jump right into this second section on identifying markers for cognitive decline. While we have objective tools to assess cognitive decline, we also take into consideration a person's subjective experience, as in if they notice that their memory is faltering or that they have trouble with reasoning. However, some doubt its relevance in properly diagnosing AD and predicting its progression. This is what we refer to as subjective memory decline, the topic of paper number 6, titled Relevance of Subjective Cognitive Decline in Older Adults with a First Degree Family History of Alzheimer's Disease. You'll find it published in Journal of Alzheimer's Disease by first author Wolfs Gruber. Last author is Wagneron. And this is the result of a huge collaboration. Like, the author's list extends over close to 10 lines, and the whole part of the DelCode study group. I'm not going to try to list all the affiliations, but here are some. The Journal Center for Neurodegenerative Diseases, the University of Bonn Medical Center in Germany, Medical University of Cologne, Germany too. And let's take one more. Munich Cluster for Systems Neurology. I love seeing big collaborations like this. Gives me hope in the future. All right. Here, the authors want to see how subjective memory decline correlates with objective Alzheimer's biomarkers, such as ones found in the cerebrospinal fluid. For this, they relied on data from the DelCode study, comprising over 300 people who are cognitively healthy but have a first degree relative with AD. and others who have no family history of AD. To score subjective cognitive decline, they conducted structured interviews and compared these scores to AD biomarkers in the CSF. Although they do not specify in the abstract what biomarkers they used nor how they were measured. Here's what they found. Those with a first degree family history of Alzheimer's scored higher for subjective cognitive decline compared to those with no family history of Alzheimer's. In addition, a higher subjective cognitive decline score predicted higher Alzheimer's biomarkers in the CSF and also predicted more cognitive decline. They concluded that an objective scoring of subjective cognitive decline can help predict early Alzheimer's and its progression, especially in those with a relevant family history of Alzheimer's disease. On to paper number 7, those published in Memory and Cognition, under the title Cognitive Differences Across Ethno-Racial Category, Socioeconomic Status Across the Alzheimer's Disease Spectrum. Can an ability discrepancy score level the playing field? First author is McDonough, last author is Pop, and the affiliated with the University of Alabama and the Emory University Student Health Services in Atlanta in the US. This paper introduced me to the concept of crystallized fluid ability discrepancy. And no, you did not mistakenly venture into an organic chemistry podcast. I was confused as well. As I read on this, I realized I came across a potential answer to an issue that plagues me every time I come across cognitive tests. You may have heard me complain about the biases inherent to some cognitive tools. How can we account for cultural differences, language barriers, and education levels that may confound the results of such tests? This is why validating the translated version of tests like the Edinburgh's or MoCA can be super helpful. But what if we could come up with a personalized marker that reflects cognitive ability? For this, the authors rely on both fluid and crystallized abilities. Fluid abilities don't require existing knowledge for cognitive functioning. This may include things like processing speed or reasoning or executive function. Crystallized abilities, on the other hand, refer to knowledge that you acquired with time and correlate well with performance on language tasks. Generally, fluid ability and crystallized ability seem to go hand in hand, but in Alzheimer's, crystallized abilities seem to take a hit, while fluid abilities remain spared. The discrepancies between these two abilities may be a reliable personalized marker that is not affected by language and education level. Or is it? The authors of this paper want to test whether this marker is indeed reliable across sexes, ethnicities, and socioeconomic status. They also want to verify if this discrepancy changes with the severity of symptoms in Alzheimer's disease. Their sample spanned a wide age group from 60 to 104. Among those who were cognitively healthy, so to speak, score from traditional neuropsychological tests differed between groups by sex, educational level, and ethnicity. However, the crystallized mindless fluid abilities varied less. Across the Alzheimer's continuum, they noticed that the discrepancy between fluid and crystallized abilities widened with more severe symptoms. They did find some exceptions in their analyses, like women with higher education and some groups of Hispanic Americans. They conclude that this ability discrepancy can help bypass inherent biases we see in traditional tests. Now remember, I did give you a teaser to this abstract way earlier in abstract number 1. Because I've found some conflicting results here. So I'll leave it up to you to look at both of them and maybe I missed something here. The next abstract shares a similar interest, that is, to identify a subject-specific marker. However, they go through a more traditional route that may be known to you if you're a regular listener, a test called the Alzheimer's Disease Assessment Scale, or ADAS-COG. It was developed way back in 1980 and comes in two versions, non-cognitive and cognitive. You can guess which one is used today clinically and academically in the context of Alzheimer's. Know that in ADAS non-cog, you would be looking at mood and behavioral changes, while in ADAS cog, 11 tasks are administered to test memory, language, and praxis. Some of the tasks included in ADAS-COG are word recall, naming, orientation, and language. This is the very test that comes up in abstract number 8 called Influence of Subject Specific Effects in Longitudinal Modeling of Cognitive Decline in Alzheimer's Disease. And you'll find it published in Journal of Alzheimer's Disease by Murchison, first author. Last author is Kennedy, and they're affiliated with the University of Alabama at Birmingham in the U.S., Wake Forest University in the U.S. as well. Here, the authors focus on markers specific to individuals as measured by the ADAS-Cog subscale. They employ various statistical maneuvers and models, which are actually all described in the abstract, but we'll contend with listing some of them verbatim. The parameterizations for clinical trial simulations, analogous mixed effects regression models, parameterized directly, and random forest ensemble models. The authors noticed greater prediction error across all models due to an increase in variance, reflecting severe subject-specific effects in the ADAS-Cog test. They suggest that limiting variance may exaggerate population-specific effects. So as I understand this, if we sacrifice individual-level variations, we may be falling prey to population-level variation. They do conclude that a better understanding of subject-specific effects may help us in prognosis. This abstract was way over my head, as my training in statistics is quite limited. So I hope I did it justice, or at least encourage you to check the original work. The last abstract is a bit of an outlier here, as it doesn't focus on a cognitive marker, but rather on predicting disease trajectory. Perhaps it would have been a better fit in another episode on understanding cognitive changes in Alzheimer's, or even identifying risk factors, but I'm glad I came across it nonetheless. Please join me in welcoming abstract number 9 and also the last of today's episode, titled Global Cognitive Trajectory Patterns in Alzheimer's Disease, and you'll find it published in International Psychogeriatrics by first author Cohen, last author Yaffe, affiliated with SUNY Downstate Health Center University in Brooklyn and New York University. Here, the authors rely on data derived from the National Alzheimer's Coordinating Center, or NACC, across 36 Alzheimer's disease research centers for 414 individuals. They also use the MMSE results and a complete annual assessment for 5 years. They ended up identifying 5 different trajectories for cognitive decline: fast decline, slow decline, zigzag stable, and improvement. They even listed some subtypes and characteristics for these groups. For example, fast decline seems to correlate with female sex, a lower score on the MMSE at baseline, a shorter illness, and taking a medication for cognitive enhancement. If the person showed a decrease in MMSE score by 3 or more points early on, one may expect a poorer prognosis. The authors report that not having the APOE4 allele and male sex predicted a better prognosis. And very interestingly, so did a higher rate of traumatic brain injuries, which is counterintuitive, to say the least. My reviewer Anusha suggested that perhaps TBI is correlated with heavier exercise or more acute hospital care throughout life. Good suggestion. The cognitive trajectories outlined in this paper can help not only for prognosis, but also for clinical research. Though, future research should look at the consistency of these categories. All right, we made it till the end, you and I. Thanks for sticking with me through 2 episodes on clinical testing in Alzheimer's disease. They are a nice bridge between what we learn in school and cutting-edge stuff in research land. And I thank all the scientists worldwide who work so hard to continuously challenge and improve clinical practice. Did any of the papers stick out to you? What are your highlights? If a paper caught your interest, you can find the bibliography for this in the show notes, which I generated for you. If you go to our site, aminder.com, and click on Bibliography at the top of the page, you will be redirected to our drive where we keep all past bibliographies. We update it as we release episodes and also add the bibliographies for the topics that we do not cover. Every month, we download all the abstracts with the word Alzheimer in them, categorize them into categories, and assign those categories to hosts, depending on the area of interest and expertise. Naturally, many topics do not get covered, and we'd love to recruit more people who care about SciComm and want an extra incentive to keep up with the news in their field. Aside from the experience, you also get to interact with scientists from all around the world. We have team members from 6 different time zones, from Canada, the US, Germany, the UK, India, and Turkey, working consistently to bring you episodes 3 times a week. We do take breaks between months to recharge and sort papers. So thank you to the amazing team that we have. The beautiful music you hear now is the making of Anusha Kamesh, one of our regular hosts and manager of our editing team. You can find her work on AK Music on YouTube or on SoundCloud under her name. I also thank her for her astute comments and edits on my script before I recorded it today. And I do have to give a special shout out to my co-manager, Ellen Kosh, who coordinates the schedule and internal communications and somehow made the time to edit this episode. And last but not least, thank you for following us and listening to our episodes. I hope you found this podcast useful and accessible. Until next time,